He's been a member of Israel's delegation to the 38th General Assembly. He was the first Secretary for Information at the Embassy of Israel in Washington, D.C. He was also Chief Writer and Advisor for Information at the Ministry of Foreign Affairs. He's been the Deputy Consul General of Israel in Los Angeles, New York, and New York. And he was also the counselor as the North American Division of the Ministry of Foreign Affairs. And since 2002, he has been the director of the Israel Information Center in Jerusalem. And I'll go ahead and ask you all to welcome him. This should be a very good time.
Shalom, good evening. I hope everyone can hear me back there. Okay, thank you. I want to thank you very much for giving me this opportunity to speak with you this evening. And I want to thank you for coming to hear what I have to say on behalf of the State of Israel and our people. I think to begin, I'd like to quote two famous people. One's a famous American, another's a famous British leader. And I think in certain ways what they're saying is very appropriate for what we're going through now. In his famous book, 1956 Profiles in Courage, John Fitzgerald Kennedy said the following: "A man does what he must, in spite of personal consequences, in spite of obstacles and dangers and pressures. And that is the basis of all human morality." The other person I want to quote was the leader of the United Kingdom of Great Britain during World War II, Sir Winston Churchill, who in the House of Commons said the following: "Victory at all costs, victory in spite of all terror, victory however long and hard the road may be, for without victory there is not survival." I think those two statements are very appropriate for what we are facing today when it comes to the Middle East, and both in terms of prospects for peace, the dangers that are out there because of terrorism and extremism, and also the nuclear threat. There comes in the history of any nation and people critical moments of choice. Those critical moments may come very often, or they may come every once in a while. Israel, since we were reestablished in 1948, has always sought peace with our neighbors. It was expressed very clearly and directly in our very Declaration of Independence. And we've shown on numerous occasions that in order to achieve peace, we are willing to make major concessions and sacrifices. We showed it, for example, when we gave up the entire Sinai Peninsula in exchange for the peace treaty with Egypt. We showed it in the Oslo Accords and in our attempt to reach an agreement with the Palestinians at the second Camp David summit, when we virtually agreed to establishing a Palestinian state on 97% of the West Bank and Gaza. And again recently, our Prime Minister Ariel Sharon, and we all hope for his speedy recovery after his stroke, he initiated a bold move called the Disengagement Plan, which basically took Israel out of the Gaza Strip. In so doing, we had to uproot thousands of people who had lived there for decades, literally decades, their homes, their livelihoods, and all this. In addition to that, of course, the forced settlements in northern Samaria. And while this, of course, was intended to serve our interests as a country, it also was intended to promote peace, to get us out of the stalemate in which we found ourselves with the Palestinians, and to give the Palestinians an opportunity to show us and the world that they are indeed sincere when they talk about peace, that they are indeed credible partners when it comes to not only living up to their obligations, but also establishing a responsible, democratic, and free state, which would live in peace with Israel. Well, we did what we had to do, and we had hoped that it would be a positive opening for something much grander in terms of reaching peace with the Palestinians. However, the Palestinians also had their historic opportunity. Actually, they've had a number of them over the past several decades. Five times in history they could have had a Palestinian state, and five times they ended up without one because they didn't want, in those years, a Palestinian state alongside Israel. Their goal was a Palestinian state instead of Israel. We thought that under Mahmoud Abbas, he would seize the opportunity, and we do believe he's a moderate individual, a moderate leader. We thought he would seize the opportunity, the Palestinians would seize the opportunity and do what they have to do under their international obligations and commitments. For example, under the roadmap. Can you hear me back there? Okay. Well, I'm trying to say this. Which basically stipulated that Palestinians have to dismantle the terrorist infrastructure, they have to arrest terrorist leaders, they have to confiscate weapons. And we were told that they needed elections to give them the legitimacy, the mandate to do this. Well, they had their opportunity. They had their elections, and they made a big mess of it. They made a big mess of it. The victory of Hamas is a major blow to prospects for peace between us and the Palestinians. It's a major blow to regional stability. It is a victory, at least in the, for the time being, for terrorism. And it is a danger to all of us who wish to put an end to this plague, this threat of international terrorism. Let me take those points one by one. Hamas is not just any other organization. It is not just another nationalist Palestinian organization. It is an organization which has brought to the foreground suicide bombings. It is responsible for over 40% of the suicide bombings which have killed hundreds of Israelis in the last 4.5 years. It was responsible for other suicide bombings in the 90s during the height of the Oslo peace process. It is an organization which openly calls for the destruction of the state of Israel and openly says that it will not, under any stretch of the imagination, agree ever to negotiate or to recognize the existence of the state of Israel, the right of Israel to exist, or to make peace with Israel. If you read what they said just prior to the elections, and they continue to say it today, they said things like, the constants and the strategy of Hamas do not change according to circumstances. Hamas will stay faithful to jihad, to resistance, to guns, to Palestine, and to Jerusalem. Hamas will enter the Palestinian Legislative Council on the platform of resistance. The Europeans and the Americans are telling Hamas to choose between arms and parliament. We say we will go for arms and parliament, and there's no contradiction between the two of them. Of course, in what proper democracy does an armed group run for political power? The last time something like that happened was in the 30s in Germany, which led to the rise of Adolf Hitler and the Nazi Party as the dictator of that country. If you look at the covenant of the Hamas, which was written in 1988, a year after the organization came into being, it makes it clear that they seek the destruction of Israel. And they continue to say this to this very day. Israel will exist and will continue to exist until Islam will obliterate it, just as it obliterated others before it. Ranks will close, fighters joining other fighters, and masses everywhere in the Islamic world will come forward in response to the call of duty, loudly proclaiming, "Hail to Jihad." This cry will reach the heavens and will go on being resounded until liberation is achieved, the invaders vanquished, and Allah's victory comes about. It's an anti-Semitic group. And I say anti-Semitic, I don't mean only anti-Israel, as extreme as an anti-Israeli policy is, also anti-Semitic. In its very charter, it has statements like the following. The day of judgment will not come about until Muslims fight Jews and kill them. Then the Jews will hide behind rocks and trees, and the rocks and trees will cry out, "O Muslim, there is a Jew hiding behind me, come and kill him." And just very recently, the head of Hamas in Damascus, Khalid Mish'al, in a speech he made at a mosque in Damascus, said the following, included the following statement, "We say to the West that you will be defeated in Palestine, and the defeat has begun. Tomorrow, our people, the Prophet, will be on the throne of power in the world. That is a fact. Tomorrow, we shall rule the world." These are statements from Hamas. So, I don't think it should come as any surprise when, first of all, we say, we, government of Israel and the people of Israel, we will have nothing to do with Hamas or a Hamas-influenced government in the Palestinian Authority. A Palestinian Authority influenced by Hamas or ruled by Hamas is not just a government that will support terrorism, it is a terrorist government. And I think anyone who is interested in winning the ultimate fight against terrorism has to fight, has to confront the terrorist government and not give any succor to it, not give any false hope to that government that they will succeed, even if they may change some of their tactics. Their strategy will remain the same, and that has to be confronted and rejected. We are so far encouraged by the world's reaction to the Hamas electoral victory. We believe that the United States, Europe, Russia, and other countries should make it very clear to Hamas and to the Palestinian Authority that if they want Hamas, then there will be consequences. That if it will be a Hamas government, there will never be a Palestinian state under those circumstances. Palestinian state is not unconditional. The existence of such a state, or the establishment of such a state, has to be based on the fact that it will be a non-terrorist state. That will be a state willing to live in peace with its neighbors. If from the outset it has a war platform that says that it is against peace with Israel, that it is for terrorism, then that is not the kind of state anyone could ever accept. Israel accepts a Palestinian state. Israel is for a Palestinian state. We are totally against a Hamas type of state. And in addition to that, there are conditions which have to be met. And those conditions, by the way, are the conditions that everyone is talking about, not just Israel. One, that a Palestinian Authority government, especially one led by Hamas and Hamas as well, have to renounce terrorism. And when I say renounce it, not just in words, because we had a situation like that with Arafat where he renounced it and supported it at the same time. It has to be an action as well. Renouncing completely and unconditionally terrorism. Two, it has to recognize the right of Israel to exist. And that is an axiom, because without that there is no peace. Three, it has to adhere to all existing agreements between us and the Palestinian Authority. And four, it has to adhere to the roadmap, which states very explicitly, and again, the roadmap was the plan formulated by the United States, the European Union, Russia, and the UN, which says that the Palestinians have to, at the first stage of the peace process, dismantle terrorist organizations, confiscate arms, arrest terrorist leaders and activists, and in addition to that, also stop incitement to hatred. If it does that, if by some miracle it does that, then we are willing to negotiate with any Palestinian who acts according to that basis. I would say that I believe that that is as much possible for Hamas to do as the Ku Klux Klan to turn into a group for liberal policies and peaceful coexistence. And I would say it has much chance of doing that as the mafia has of turning into a law enforcement agency. No one should mistake Hamas for something other than it is, a very dangerous obstacle to peace. It also has its links with other radical groups in the region. If not active links, certainly philosophical links. Its philosophy is the same philosophy, the exact same philosophy as Al-Qaeda, as Hezbollah, and the worst terrorist groups that have attacked your country on that terrible day, 9/11, and other countries, whether Spain, the UK, and in the Far East, in Indonesia, and in India. It is a very dangerous group on the local level. But there are other dangers, too. Hamas is a problem for us, a big problem for us. And for the Palestinians, we have yet to see what kind of government they're going to now be getting. But look at a country like Iran. Iran is if Hamas is a big danger, Iran is a super danger. Because Iran, with a nuclear weapon, will be 100 times worse in terms of the threat it will pose to Israel, to the region, and to the world than Iran without a nuclear weapon. And what is Iran without a nuclear weapon? Iran without a nuclear weapon is a country that supports terrorism. We know it stands behind groups like Hezbollah and Hamas. Iran without a nuclear weapon is a country that opposes the peace process between Israel and the Palestinians. It openly declares that. Iran is a country whose vile president, and I don't use that term lightly, calls for the destruction of Israel, denies the existence of the Holocaust, and that is a country which does so now when it doesn't have a nuclear weapon. Can you imagine what it will do when it will have a nuclear weapon? When it will be able to threaten countries that don't follow its bidding? When it will be able to threaten the countries around it, like the Persian Gulf, and say, if you don't do what we want, beware, when it will be openly able to support terrorism without even trying to conceal that it isn't, when it is developing missiles that can reach almost every region in the Middle East today, let alone could reach for example, if they don't already reach Southern Europe, and maybe even one day the United States. Our position is that we support, as a first step, but a vital step, and a step that has to be followed upon very soon, the decision of the IAEA to refer the Iranian nuclear threat to the UN Security Council, and also for the UN Security Council to act quickly, and this is what we do believe has to be done in conjunction with the entire international community, because this is not just an Israeli matter, it is a matter that pertains to the safety and stability of the entire world, have to take strong, effective measures against Iran, whatever is necessary. Whatever price may be paid for resisting Iran today is nothing compared to the price you would maybe have to pay once Iran will have a nuclear bomb. If people, for example, are worried about the price of oil going up because the Iranians will react to sanctions, imagine what could happen if one day the Iranians, and we're talking not talking about a pragmatic regime, we're talking about a regime of religious fanatics. Imagine what could happen one day to oil prices if they were to bomb the Saudi oil fields with a nuclear bomb, or do other similar things, or force the Saudis and others to raise the price of oil, or else. This is very dangerous. We're not even talking about the kind of situation that existed in the days of the Cold War against the Soviet Union. As bad as the Soviet Union was, it was a secular regime with pragmatic interests involved. It wasn't a regime, for example, as bad as it was, which applauded suicide bombers and which gave support to suicide terrorism. A country which will support suicide terrorism is a country that is not that far away from actually committing suicide in order to believe that its people may go up to heaven. And that's the danger and the risk we face. So this is a problem that has to be addressed quickly. Iran is linked with Syria. In fact, if you needed a proof of that, all you have to do is look at what happened just 2 weeks ago, where the president of Iran visited Damascus and met openly with the president of Syria. Now, Syria is not a peace-loving country. We know that it has subjugated Lebanon for years. We know that it has been accused, and all evidence points to the fact that the president of Syria, Bashar al-Assad, and the Syrian regime was behind the brutal assassination of the Lebanese prime minister. We know that it is weak when it comes to confronting Israel, but if it could, it would. And it certainly hosts all the most dangerous anti-Israel terrorist organizations in Damascus. Now, if Syria, for example, was to be backed by an Iranian nuclear umbrella, all mischief would come out and break forth. Then Syria could very easily act as a proxy for Iran, and the big brother would provide the little brother with the kind of support it needs to do anything the big brother wants and anything the Syrians want. It is a very dangerous situation, even short of Iran using a nuclear weapon. And of course, Hezbollah, which has been defined by the United States as one of the worst terrorist organizations in the world, is backed actively by both Iran and Syria. So we very much believe that these are the threats that we are facing today. In Israel's fight against terrorism, and we are not, Israel does not exist in a very tolerant region. Religious fanaticism and violence is very, very rampant when it comes to the Middle East. And one of the reasons we are attacked as a country is because we represent Western values in the Middle East. We're the only country that represents Western values in the Middle East. And they know that. And the enemies of the United States and of the West and the Middle East are attacking us because they don't want us there, just like they attack the United States and others because they don't want you there. And they also don't want you where you are, which is in the United States. You know, when the Al-Qaeda bombed Madrid, they said openly that one of their aims is ultimately to liberate what they called Southern Andalusia from Spain. Southern Andalusia is the last area lost by the Muslim Moors to Spain, in the late part of the 15th century. And they are also saying, as I just mentioned in the quote by the Hamas leader, as well as Al-Qaeda, that they eventually want to bring about the downfall of the United States, not in the Middle East, but the downfall of the United States and the destruction of the West and the rise of Islam, their version of Islam. I'm going to say a word about that in a second. Their version of Islam to power. Now, we have to distinguish and should never make the mistake of confusing Islam as a positive holy faith and Islamist extremists. They are not one and the same. Islam should be respected. Islamist extremists have to be fought and confronted. And if we don't, we don't do so at our own peril. There have been efforts to achieve peace in the Middle East. Sometimes we thought we were close. Other times we found we were not that close. But if you look at the positive elements that do exist in the Arab and Muslim world, and we know they're out there because we have had contact with them, it leads us to hope that given determination in fighting terrorism, in fighting extremism, while also seizing, if there are opportunities, the chance for peace, gives us the feeling, the belief that eventually we will prevail in the quest for peace. Genuine peace of coexistence and cooperation in the region. The reason I say that is if you consider that whatever differences, and sometimes they're very vocal, we have with between us, for example, in Egypt or us in Jordan, the relations that have existed since the signing of the peace treaties between Israel and those countries have moved, sometimes more slowly than quickly, but have moved forward. They too face the threat of it. Radical Islamist groups. We have had ties which have developed between us and, for example, other countries in the Middle East. We have, for example, full diplomatic relations with Mauritania. We have contacts with countries in the Persian Gulf. We have contacts with North Africa. We have an Arabic website in the Foreign Ministry, which has received literally hundreds of thousands of visitors. I'm talking about the Israeli Foreign Ministry getting hundreds of thousands of visitors from the Arab world, and many of them have expressed positive sentiments about the need to end the conflict and move towards peace. We know they're out there. We also know they're threatened by the extremists among them. If you've had, for example, cases of Palestinians who've said that the Palestinians have to be realistic and that there's no way that they or anyone can expect Israel to allow in refugees, which are dedicated to the destruction of Israel, which were born on hatred of Israel, to come into our country and to basically destroy us from within. And we're talking about now not only and there's no Israeli who would ever accept Palestinian refugees coming into our country, but I'm talking about modern Palestinians who've said this. They have been threatened with death by some of their fellow Palestinians. And we know of Palestinians who've been killed by other Palestinians just for saying the wrong thing. From their perspective, for advocating peace with Israel. When it comes to making peace, we have to bear in mind that in order to achieve peace, ultimately, we're going to need concessions from both sides. Israel knows, we know, we are going to have to make concessions for peace. We're going to have to compromise. We will not be able to realize all of our dreams. All of our dreams, which are based on rights, by the way. I'm not saying we don't have rights. But we are willing to forego some of those rights because we believe peace is also very important. We also don't want to rule the Palestinians just as we wouldn't want to be ruled by any foreign power. We recognize that. But for there to be peace, there has to be negotiations. There has to be give and take on both sides. We have to make concessions, but so do the Palestinians. And only by concessions, only by giving and taking on both sides, can an agreement be hammered out by both sides. We prefer that. In his speech at the Herzliya conference 2 weeks ago, Acting Prime Minister Ehud Olmert said that we will make concessions if there's a possibility for peace, that we will, and we do prefer, agreements with the Palestinians. But if there is no one on the other side capable or desiring of doing this, then we will take whatever measures are necessary on our own to protect our citizens and our vital rights and interests, as any country would when it would face a similar situation, as your country would, and as any responsible government and country would. The possibility of peace is not unimaginable, but it does depend on whether the Palestinians are really serious partners, and so far, I regret to say, they've been proving time and again that they're not. That every time they have an opportunity to show us in the world that they're moderate, as we saw again recently, both in the kinds of contacts they have with certain groups outside the Palestinian territories, as well as Israel, that they are not yet interested in peace. At least some of them are, and certainly the leadership part of it doesn't want it, and now Hamas government definitely would not want it. I want to say two other things, and then I'll open the floor to questions and comments you would have. When it comes to our relations around the world, we have a lot of good relations, but there's nothing that begins to compare to the relationship we have with the United States. The United States is not just, in political terms, Israel's number one friend and ally, and we do enjoy support of the U.S. administration, of Congress, and this has gone back also, if you see in opinion polls in Gallup opinion polls since 1948, the majority of Americans have always supported Israel, but also in the way we feel about the United States. In Israel, you know that the United States is very popular. It's always been very popular. And when American sailors in the Sixth Fleet come to Haifa port, they feel like they're home. Because Israel is a Western society. We also respect tradition. We have also people from the East. When I say Western, that doesn't mean we don't respect Eastern tradition. We don't have, doesn't mean we don't have Arabs or Jews who live or come to Israel from Muslim countries. We have that. When I talk about Western, I'm talking about the fact that, first of all, we are a democracy, a pluralistic democracy. It's not the American-style democracy. It's not a presidential system. It's a parliamentary democracy, but we are a democracy. When our prime minister, Ariel Sharon, was struck by his illness, Israel did not fall apart. We had an orderly transfer of power to the acting prime minister. We have an interim government. Elections will be held in Israel in 2 months. By the way, those elections were called before Sharon's stroke. And I can tell you this, that whoever will win, whether it'll be Kadima, Labor, or Likud, whoever will win, the basic policy of Israel will remain the same, with few nuances and different variations, but basically the same. We will fight terrorism as vigorously and as effectively as we need to, and we're not going to in any way give in to the terrorists. And we'll also seize whatever opportunity may arise to move for peace. But this is only one aspect of Israel, our democratic system. It's a very important aspect. We value our democracy. We are also a modern society. A modern society which is up there with every Western country you can think of when it comes to scientific achievement and high technology. Motorola, Intel, and others have research and development sites in Israel, and we have won Nobel Prizes. We have innovations that most people are not aware of as Israeli innovations. Take this little thing here. It looks like a pill. In a way, I suppose it is, but it isn't. It's a small miniature camera, which was invented in Israel, and is used by doctors to take a look at the gastrointestinal system and provide a survey of what's happening there. This is just one Israeli innovation. The Intel Pentium chip was developed in Israel. A lot of what you use in terms of cell phone technology was developed in Israel. When someone once wrote about, in reference to those who sometimes call for boycotting Israel, if they're really sincere about boycotting Israel, then they should throw out their cell phones and their computers. Because Israel is in that. We have, when it comes to cultural activities, everything that you have here, not in numbers, certainly, but in terms of different kinds of groups, world-renowned orchestras, and also famous singers and dancers. We couldn't beat the NBA, probably, but we won the European Cup in basketball 5 times. We won the European Eurovision Song Contest 3 times. Israeli wines have won international awards. Israelis like to go to the beach, and they like to go to the restaurants, they like to shop, and they work, and they play. We do all of this, just as you do here. And that is important to remember about Israel. We are not just a country of conflict, of fighting terrorism. We have that. We're not just a country where religion has an important role to play, because we are, after all, in what is called the Holy Land. And we are a place that is important to the three monotheistic faiths. Jerusalem, which of course hosts shrines which are important to Judaism, Christianity, and Islam. We are that. But we're also a society with everything else imaginable in terms of Western democratic culture. And that is something to bear in mind about Israel. Israel beyond the headlines, Israel beyond the conflict. I would like to conclude my talk today by quoting Theodor Herzl. Theodor Herzl was the founder of modern Zionism. Zionism is nothing more and nothing less than the establishment, a rebirth of the Jewish people in its own home. Actually, I would like to quote two famous people in that regard. Theodor Herzl, who in the end of the 19th century launched the movement to bring back the Jewish people to the land of Israel, Eretz Israel, and there always were Jews living there, by the way, it wasn't ever empty completely of Jews, said in 1987, "In Basli, I founded the Jewish state. If I said it today, it would be greeted with laughter, but in 5 years, perhaps certainly in 50 years, everyone will see it." By the way, 50 years after he made that statement, the UN decided to establish a state, a Jewish state in Palestine. So he wasn't that far off the mark. Another famous American who had something to say about Zionism, something very important, said the following. And I'm talking about the great Martin Luther King, Jr., whose wife and fellow leader of the civil rights movement, Coretta Scott King, regrettably passed away this week. Martin Luther King, Jr., in 1967, said, "How easy it should be to understand and support the right of the Jewish people to live in their ancient land of Israel. All men of goodwill exult in the fulfillment of God's promise that his people should return in joy to rebuild their plundered land. This is Zionism, nothing more, nothing less." Thank you for your attention, and now if you have questions or comments, feel free.
How much help and aid does the U.S. give to Palestine every year?
Well, it's varied, but now I think annually it's about $70 million. And this goes to the Palestinian Authority. I understand now that because of the election results, the United States has decided, as have a number of countries, at least for the moment, to suspend aid. The last thing that anyone wants to do is to give aid which will strengthen Hamas. No one wants the Palestinians themselves to starve and to suffer, but they have elected an extremist party to power, and no one wants to strengthen Hamas. So, as of now, that aid is in jeopardy, and we'll see what happens there.
What percentage of Palestinians turned out to like to vote?
A huge percentage. It was, I understand, about 80%. It was a very huge percentage. It was in that respect, a major voter turnout. Very few countries or peoples can rival that. The problem was not that the Palestinians went to vote. Obviously, we supported that. But who they voted for. Just like when the Germans voted for the Nazis in the 30s, that was the mistake, the fatal mistake that was made at that time. And this time, too, the Palestinians, for whatever reason, it could be that they voted against the corruption of Fatah. But the results are, that makes whatever motive they voted for irrelevant. Because the results are what counts, and the result is they elected the worst, among the most extremist groups to power in the Palestinian parliament. And it remains to be seen what will happen there too, not just in terms of Israel, where we know that their policy is so, so extremely anti-Israel, against the very existence of our country, but in terms of how they'll treat Palestinians who are not, or do not subscribe to their distorted and perverted form of Islam. For example, what will they do to Palestinian Christians? What will they do to Palestinian secularists? Just before leaving for the speaking tour of the United States, I saw on Israel television a report they did in which they interviewed Palestinian Christians in Bethlehem. And they're scared stiff. Many of them are talking about leaving because they don't want to live under a Hamas government. And I don't think anyone has to stretch his imagination as to why. That doesn't mean that Hamas will necessarily take immediately the most draconian steps against these people. But eventually they will. And that's, in any case, a risk I think no one should really want to take.
How optimistic are you that the UN will do anything effective on Iran? And if not, then what?
Well, we are hoping that the UN should be effective. I mean, if it can't be effective when it comes to facing such a security threat, then what is it there for? Its purpose is to promote peace. Its purpose is to promote world stability and security, not just to be a debating society. We have debating societies, and that's legitimate. But if it was just to be a debating society or an Israel-bashing society, as we've seen it so many times in the past, then that's not why the founders of the UN created that organization. So we are hoping that it will live up to its own charter and its own reason for being and take effective steps against Iran. If not, then we think it's important the world be ready in such a case to bypass the UN and to find other means of dealing with this threat. There was another international organization that once existed that failed to meet the challenges of the time and its history. I'm talking about the League of Nations. Hopefully the UN will not follow the footpath of the League of Nations. But that's up to the UN to decide whether it wants to be relevant or not.
On the same subject, the International Atomic Energy Group, when they voted, what was it, 25-3 or whatever it was, to move forward this eventually to the United, to the Security Council.
Yeah.
In order to get those votes, apparently there were things written into this statement, including thinking the Middle East nuclear free zone, and how does that affect Israel, or what is?
We've never had a problem with that principle. Israel, by the way, is officially on record as saying that we would support a nuclear weapons free zone, provided that's negotiated and provided that all countries adhere to it in the Middle East. And also provided that there's no state of war between Israel and the Arab countries. Because the countries that threaten Israel or any country conventionally, that also is a problem. We've supported this. We're on record. For example, many times I remember us talking about the Tlatelolco agreement, which created a nuclear weapons free zone in Latin America. But the UN has to distinguish between peaceful countries and aggressive countries. Countries which would have no qualms about threatening others. And that's what we have in the case of Iran. Iran has to be literally defanged in this case because it's a threat to everybody. And therefore, that is an important first step. After it does that, and while doing that, then it can worry about other problems in the region. But the Iranian threat is too imminent and too grave to ignore. And so we know that the resolution contained the statement I referred to, but I think that everyone is much more concerned about the Iranian threat than any other possible challenges or situations that exist in the region right now.
Doesn't this give the Iranians an opportunity now to somehow or other suck Israel into the whole business as well?
No. I mean, they may try, but they won't succeed. You know, when they asked, not just the United States, but I remember a few months ago, they asked Tony Blair about Israel, and he said, one should never put Israel on the same level as Iran. Israel's not threatening anybody. Israel is not endangering the existence of anybody. It's Israel that is threatened. It's Israel's existence that is constantly being challenged. So I think that, let's say, the responsible countries of the world know that the problem is not Israel, It's Iran, and therefore it's Iran that has to be pressed here. And they may do what they want. Well, I'm more concerned not about the Iranians trying to pull Israel into this, because they won't succeed in terms of Israel. I'm afraid that they may find ways to avoid the kind of pressures that need to be applied against them in order for them to stop. They may make threats, they may cajole and bully, and as they're doing, and this may give them an out. They may play for time. That's the greatest problem we're facing. They're playing for time, because eventually they will reach the point of no return. And then whatever the world will decide to do, it'll be too late. So we should not give them the opportunity to play for time. The world has to stop Iran, pure and simple. Please.
Yeah, the Iranian president claims that Israel hasn't signed the NPT. Is that true? And if so,
yes.
Why?
We haven't signed the NPT for a number of reasons. First of all, because we face a threat which is existential. In the past, it was based on conventional military threat to Israel. You know, you were not around. I was in the Six-Day War. I was then a teenager. And I remember we won the war, fortunately. Although before the war, there was a lot of concern that Israel might not survive it. A book was written at the time. Fortunately, it was fiction. Israel had lost the war. It explained how Israel could have lost the war. And when you read the book, especially afterwards, it showed how close we were to losing the war. We also almost lost the war, at least there are signs we might have lost the war in 1973. So we faced a major conventional threat. And the question of whether Israel has or doesn't have nuclear weapons is something that countries in the region have to take into account. So we didn't sign it for that reason, but there's another reason we didn't sign it. The NPT doesn't really stop countries. You know, we believe in a truly effective nuclear-free regime, that is, system which will prevent countries from developing it. But look, the NPT has been around for a long time now. Iraq signed it, and that didn't stop Iraq from trying to develop it. That's why we took out their nuclear reactor in 1981. The Iranians signed it, and that doesn't stop them, because the problem with the NPT is that there are no mean, it doesn't have any teeth in it. It's just a declaration, and it basically relies on the, on the goodwill and honor of the countries that sign it. Now, if a country like Israel would sign it, we would feel bound by it. When we sign something, we keep our word. We keep our agreement. We do not violate it. On the other hand, if other countries, certain other countries sign it, they will use it as a cover to carry on nuclear programs behind the scenes. I'm talking about nuclear military programs. So that's why we haven't signed it. We refuse to sign it for that reason. Like I said, we would support a nuclear weapons-free zone in the Middle East, provided it is negotiated, provided it is all-inclusive, that is, not any one country in the Middle East would have nuclear weapons or could threaten Israel with it, and also provided that Israel's existence is no longer being threatened. That is, that the countries of the Middle East are willing to live in peace with Israel. Then we wouldn't have a problem with that, with the NPT or any such.
I'm concerned that, of course, Pakistan has a nuclear weapons.
Yes.
And you could say that it's just one assassination away from the Pakistan bomb being the general gunpowder.
That's potentially true, what you just said. However, I suppose you can't do anything about Pakistan because it already has a nuclear bomb. In the case of Iran, they don't yet have it. But another problem with an Iranian nuclear bomb is it will generate a nuclear arms race in the Middle East. Can you imagine how many other countries are going to try to get it? Because they will need to deter Iran. And it's a real fear that it could generate a mad nuclear arms race in the Middle East. So one country has it, as problematic as that is. Iran in this case is worse. Because at least for the moment, also Pakistan is, I wouldn't say it's moderate in everything it does, but it's not as radical as Iran. And the president of Pakistan is certainly not the kind of radical and extremist as the president of Iran. So that it's not an immediate danger. although potentially it could be, but in any case, they already have it. Iran doesn't have it. And if it doesn't have it, you stop something from bad from happening before it happens, especially when you know it will happen. I mean, why wait until we all have to face the risk?
Well, I have to admit that I have a strong naivety on this subject, so I'm not sure how accurate this can be. This is more of a moral question, I think, than anything else. But you talked earlier about how Palestine, or Israel's given Palestine many chances for a peace between the two, and it just doesn't seem like they're biting. So what, I guess, what is keeping the idea alive in Israel that Palestine will eventually want peace? Or, I mean, that it's going to be possible. Like, why doesn't Israel just step up and say, that's it, we're done, we're not taking anymore?
Well, one of the reasons is because there is no alternative. I mean, we're there. We're not in the most comfortable place to be in the world, but we're there. We're not leaving. They're not going anywhere. And so if we cannot one day learn to live with each other, then we're all doomed to fight continuously in the future wars, and there'll be continuously in the future conflict. So that's one of the reasons why we're not totally giving up and saying, for all time, there's going to be war. Secondly, situations do change. Just because the Palestinians have been unreasonable and extremist for so long doesn't mean they'll always be this way. I don't know what it will take to convince them that they have to change their tune, their dreams, that they can't hold on to fanciful, imaginary, dreams that will never be realized. They will not ever be able to take all of what they call Palestine back. Forget it. There's the state of Israel. We are there to stay. They will not be allowed to bring the refugees back into Israel. We're not about to commit suicide. By the way, there's a very famous statement which was made by Benjamin Franklin on a related subject. Of course, he didn't talk about the Palestinians at the time. But, you know, when the United States, the 13 colonies, upon forming the United States, won the war, in 1782, the British were demanding that the Loyalists be allowed back into the United States. And Benjamin Franklin, in his letter to the British negotiator, Richard Oswald, said the following. This was in 1782, a year after Yorktown. Your ministers require that we should receive again into our bosom those who have been our bitterest enemies and restore their properties who have destroyed ours. And this while the wounds they have given us are still bleeding. So we won't accept the refugees. They want their Palestinian state. That's where the refugees should go. You don't establish a state in order to send your refugees into another country. In so demanding, they are in effect demanding two Palestinian states. One for themselves, that is the residents already of West Bank and Gaza, and the other for the refugees. Well, that's a non-starter. It is now U.S. policy, by the way, not just Israeli policy, but U.S. policy that the issue of refugees can be resolved only through a Palestinian state, not through Israel. That's the first thing. Also, we are not going to give up every last inch of the West Bank and Gaza. Gaza we have to give up. But the West Bank, look, we're talking about an area which does have important security interests for us, and we do have important connections to, in terms of our historic, our religious, and other connections. We're talking about communities which existed there for some time. And President Clinton, in his letter to Ariel Sharon, a letter which I want to emphasize was backed by both houses of Congress and by both political parties, Democrats and Republicans, state that Israel should not be expected to go back to the 67 lines. The demographics have changed since 1967, and this will mean that Israel, and this is our policy, will hold afterwards the big settlement blocks, which are huge communities, along the former 67 lines. So they will get most of it, but they won't get all of it. They have to recognize that they have to be realistic too, just like we've been realistic. Now, obviously, if they will wait and wait and wait, they risk the possibility of getting less. If, for example, in the future, I'm not saying now, we are not considering this, but if in the future Israel will see there's no Palestinian that we can talk to, and we will have to determine the borders on our own, eventually we could, and then they will have to eventually live with what they are left with. They've done this before, you know, and since 1937, they could have had a state. If you look at the Peel Plan in 1937, had they accepted it then, they would have had two-thirds of what is today both West Bank, Gaza, and even the State of Israel. They didn't. And so when the 1947 UN Partition Plan was formulated, they already received less. They rejected that too. As a result, Israel was established within the ceasefire lines, the armistice lines of the pre-67 lines. Between 1949 and 1967, they could have, in theory, established a Palestinian state in all the West Bank, in all Gaza, but those territories were controlled by Egypt and Jordan. And therefore, no one on their side tried even to establish a state. The Palestinians didn't call for a state then there. Neither did the Egyptians and Jordanians. Because again, at that time, they still wanted a state instead of Israel, not alongside Israel. So that came and went. Nothing happened. In 1979, actually 1978, when we signed the Camp David Accords with Egypt, we offered in the Camp David Accords what is called the autonomy plan, which would have given them 5 years of autonomy, self-rule, and at the end of the third year, we were to begin negotiations for final status resolution of the territories. If they had accepted the plan then, they could have then negotiated with us establishing a Palestinian state. They rejected it, and they tried to punish Egypt, ostracize Egypt, for signing a peace treaty with us. So they missed that opportunity. Then we had, of course, the period of Oslo since 1993 and the second Camp David summit. Now, had they accepted the terms that were put forth, the positions that were put forth, not just by Israel, but especially by President Clinton, which would have given the Palestinians control of 97% of the territory, would have given them control of parts of Jerusalem, would have meant dismantling most of the settlements. Had they accepted all of this, they would have had a state today. Instead, they totally rejected it, and Clinton, because of their demands, for example, regarding the refugees, etc., President Clinton and others recognized that they made a big mistake, that they were totally obstinate to the Palestinians. And instead, the Palestinians launched the Intifada Terror Campaign for the last 4.5 years. So they missed that opportunity. Now, too, they had an opportunity and they messed it up. If they continue, they'll be left with very little. Eventually, we will do what we need to do to protect ourselves. We prefer, as I said, we very much prefer reaching an agreement with the Palestinians. They do, in principle, deserve a Palestinian state. But principle does not make reality if they want to establish a terrorist state. No one is going to support the existence of another terrorist state in the region. We have enough of them, whether in the form of Syria or Iran and some others that have existed in the past. So it's up to them. We're hopeful, however, that with time, saner minds will prevail over there. Please.
How long before Iran can have a nuclear weapon?
Well, there's some debate, but there's a feeling that most we have only several months before they reach the point of no return. That doesn't mean they'll have the bomb right away. But once they reach the point where they can have complete access to nuclear technology, what they need to build a bomb, then after that it'll be next to impossible to stop them from getting it.
Do you, in your heart, believe that they will agree to these four conditions of peace?
Hamas? No. What I said is like asking the mafia to become a law enforcement agency. I don't believe that Hamas is capable of this because it's ingrained in them. It's not just their competition of two nationalisms. It's their extreme perverted interpretation of Islam. It's a religious faith taken to an extreme nature.
I don't mean necessarily Hamas, but the Palestinians.
Well, the Palestinians have already agreed to it. The Palestinian Authority basically did agree to it. Whether they actually implemented it or something else. But since Oslo, the Palestinians, yes, have agreed to these terms. So the question is what will happen with Hamas and a Palestinian Authority government dominated by Hamas.
Real quick, I'm sorry for interrupting, but for those of us who don't know, if that's anybody else but me, what is the Palestinian Authority?
Palestinian Authority is the name, which for the meantime is the only official name of the areas controlled by the Palestinians. They're not yet officially called Palestine, by the way. I know that's a mistake a lot of countries make. That may be what they will call themselves in the future, if and when they get a state, but their official name and title is the Palestinian Authority. That was the term that was agreed to both by Israel and the Palestinians when we signed the Oslo Accords. So that's why it's called the Palestinian Authority, for short, the PA.
Do you foresee a time when the PA will agree to these 4 points?
Well, I said they already did.
I mean, actively implement them.
Oh, okay. I don't know, because up till now they failed to implement them, each and every one of them, except for maybe one, which they did in effect implement when they when the PLO abandoned the PLO charter in terms of recognizing the right of Israel to exist. Even then, it wasn't an explicit recognition. It was an implicit recognition when the PLO annulled the PLO charter. But in all the others, they made some nice-sounding statements, and I do believe that Mahmoud Abbas, Abu Mazen, is sincere when he says that he's against terrorism, that he wants peace with Israel, but they've never really carried out their end of the bargain. They've never taken any action to dismantle terrorist infrastructure. They've never taken any action to arrest terrorist leaders and to stop the chaos which has run amok in their areas. And that's the problem. So I don't know whether they will ever live up to their commitments, but they have made commitments.
Will Israel ever back down from any of these four?
No. And I think if you look at, why should we? I mean, that's right. The base of peace. If they do not stop to abandon terrorism, if they do not recognize Israel's right to exist, if they do not honor their own agreements that they've signed with us, and if they do not honor the terms of the roadmap, which basically contain all the key elements, which I talked about earlier, then who are we making peace with? Then it's just going through the process, a phony process of pretending you're making peace, whereas you're ending up with an agreement which you know the other side will not honor. We are not about to engage in a futile exercise of pretending to make peace if the Palestinians are not going to honor, and we know in advance they're not going to honor their agreement. So they have to take action. You know, we thought Arafat meant business when he agreed to these conditions, when he wrote the letter to Rabin saying he totally renounces terrorism and incitement, and he views the only means for reaching a solution between Israel and the Palestinians as negotiations, that is the form of negotiations. That was his commitment. And we all know that Arafat failed miserably to honor his commitment. That not only did he do nothing to stop terrorism, he actually fomented it and backed it. So, if they are serious, if the Palestinians are serious, this time, let's say that after the last 4 years, we Israelis, are not about to believe in words any longer when it comes to Palestinians. If you want to see action. If there's action, the kind of action that's necessary, fine. Then they know what we can do. In fact, when we disengaged, when we left the Gaza Strip, we even showed what we would do unilaterally without them yet giving anything in return. But now they have to show what they're going to do, and that means action.
Do you support the new Forward government, and do you think it will be successful in March?
Kadima, you mean?
Yes.
I personally can't say, me personally?
Yeah.
No, I cannot say what I support or don't support. I'm a civil servant. I'm an official representative of the State of Israel. I cannot openly support any political party. It would be wrong. I represent a democratic government, a democratic people, and I will work on behalf of any government that is elected.
I'm just wondering if you would comment, say, on the balance of power in Fatah between Abbas and Bashar, for instance. I mean, was that ever really a movement for peace?
Fatah?
Yeah.
I don't know if Fatah was a movement for peace, but I can tell you that there are people in Fatah that are for peace. Look, Fatah has its own groups, and some of them are definitely no angel. If you look at the Al-Aqsa Martyrs Brigade, who was responsible, along with Islamic Jihad, for launching Qassam rockets against our people. And therefore, we do take action against the Al-Aqsa Martyr Brigade's terrorists, just as we did today. Just as we took action against Islamic terrorists yesterday. So, and they belong to Fatah. On the other hand, you do have certain people within Fatah who are moderate, who do want peace, who like Mahmoud Abbas. And even if we may disagree very strongly with him on specific issues, and that's a legitimate disagreement, which has to be resolved through negotiations, with them we believe, at least in principle, we can reach a deal, give maybe a bit of time. But unfortunately, they appear to be weak. Another thing which has certainly hurt Fatah tremendously has been the rampant corruption there, where literally millions and millions of dollars have been misused, have gone into private pockets, and have not been used for the benefit of the Palestinian people. And that's one of the reasons why, that as well as the fact that some money was finding its way into the hands of terrorists was one of the reasons why the European Union reviewed its policy of providing support and decided to then give support to the Palestinians based on specific criteria for monitoring the use of those funds. That's another reason why Europe today is saying that it is not going to give funds to Hamas unless it does certain things. We believe that it's very important here, again, that funds not be given carte blanche to the Palestinians. For them to get funds, they have to show that they're going to use them responsibly for developing the humanitarian needs, and I would say the needs that any legitimate country has in terms of its people, but not for terrorism, not for lining pockets of individuals, and not for following extremist policies against Israel and against peace.
But just today or yesterday, it was announced that Israel was going to turn over, how many millions of dollars in tax money?
Not exactly. What has been decided is that we're taking a close look at that. We are considering, for the moment, it has been suspended. A final decision, I think, has yet to be taken. I know it's been carefully looked at. Our foreign minister is now in Washington, or will be in Washington this week. I'm sure that will be an issue we'll be discussed. We're going to take a good look at this, because on the one hand, we definitely don't want to do anything, and I mean anything, whether directly or indirectly, which will prop up Hamas. On the other hand, we don't want to cause undue hardship to the Palestinians. Even if they made the stupid mistake of electing the wrong kind of people, we don't want the average Palestinian to suffer needlessly. We don't want to see scenes of Palestinians starving, for example.
Does any of that money ever get to the Palestinian people?
Sometimes. It depends how it's done.
Well, there
are clear requirements now, or there have been in place clear requirements in terms of transparency of the use of money and monitoring. But now there's definitely a new problem that has arisen with Hamas. I think this is something that has to be discussed, but we have to, on one hand, while showing concern for the legitimate needs of the Palestinians, we have to be very careful and be very, very firm, and even if necessary, tough, when it comes to making sure that money is not sent in any way which will prop up Hamas. That will be very dangerous, if not in the short term, then in the long run.
What do you see as the outcome of the Danish newspaper cartoons?
Well, I don't know what the outcome will be. I don't know what the outcome will be. But we in Israel have always distinguished between, as I said, Islam and Islamist extremists. And we also believe that it's very important to draw this distinction. We believe that when it comes to religious symbols, we have to be careful. But I also think that no one, I think, can even begin to legitimize the kind of reaction we've seen in the Arab and Muslim world to what has happened. And I'm talking about the torching of embassies and attacks on Europeans. You know, in Gaza Strip, the European Union offices, the Europeans have supported the Palestinians, and the European offices were trashed, and armed gangs were going around hunting for Europeans to take hostage. That's unacceptable. And also, I just wish that our Arab neighbors, especially certain governments, would be as sensitive to the kind of anti-Semitic campaign which they've seen in their press as they are sensitive to what is viewed as assaults on Islam. I mean, some of these governments have had horrendous policies. I'm talking about not just private newspapers, but I'm talking about government-sponsored, government-controlled newspapers or television, which have shown the worst possible anti-Semitic propaganda on their screens and in their pages, and some of those, and I'd say in some cases that propaganda wouldn't put the Nazis to shame, literally. So that's the kind of problem we have. Unfortunately, when it comes to the Middle East, you have a lot of crazy and extremist elements out there. I wouldn't say that's the dominant form or shape of the Middle East, but it's the most prominent right now and the most vocal. And certainly the most dangerous when it comes to, again, seeing the kind of reactions we've seen. So that's something that I think everyone is concerned about. We, of course, hope that ultimately it will all be resolved for the better. Please. You, and then you.
The United Nations is not known for acting promptly in the best interests of countries that aren't Western and diplomatic. And you're saying that Iran only has a couple of months?
Well, I didn't say a couple. Several.
Do you think that the UN seems to be moving rapidly now? Making the steps that it needs to make very quickly?
That they will do what they need to do?
Yeah. Is there any sign?
I don't think we can be that optimistic, no. Again, I think it depends on the determination of the world. If the world's going to also go through the, say, the empty steps of pretending pressure Iran while not really doing so, then we won't get anywhere. I think it's very, very important that the world act effectively and firmly against this threat. It has to be made clear to Iran that if they continue to go ahead with this, they will pay a very heavy price. That it's not a matter of opposing legitimate peaceful interests on the part of Iran, but it's a matter of confronting a real threat which no one in the world, not Israel, not the countries of the Middle East, not Europe, not the United States, not Russia and China, can accept, because it will be a danger ultimately to everybody.
But do you think that the present American government is pushing hard enough to do this?
Well, yeah, we are in good contact with the U.S. government. I don't want to go into detail because I'm not also privy exactly to all those contacts, but I think there's a good dialogue between us and the United States. That's what needs to be done, and we do believe it's important for the United States to be a key player in pushing for this. We do know the United States is a key player in pushing for this.
In these recent elections, when they had the massive turnouts that voted for the Hamas, do the average Palestinian man and woman support the extremist policies of the Hamas?
Well, that's a good question. There are some indications which seem to indicate that they don't. But that, again, doesn't matter if in the end they vote Hamas into power. I don't think that the German people in voting for Hitler and the Nazi Party thought that he would start World War II. But that's what happened. And we don't know, let's say this, while the reports that indicate that most Palestinians today want to see an end to suicide bombings and want to end the conflict with Israel, reach some kind of agreement with Israel, that's besides the point if they elected into power a party which is opposed to all that.
And everyone knows that they're opposed to it all.
Of course.
Yeah. All right, we're going to need to wrap this up. Maybe just one more question.
Last question. I expect the answer to be a very short one. Can an Israeli civil servant comment on how the election of Hamas might affect Israeli politics in the next election?
No, because first of all, we don't know how it will affect Israeli politics. That remains to be seen, right?
That was too easy.